Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
And welcome to another episode of the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. Before we get into the topic of today's episode, I want to give a big shout out to our subscribers at TrentHornPodcast.com. You're the ones who make the podcast possible, and that is why you are the ones who get access to all kinds of bonus content, like sneak peek of episodes or the exclusive ability to be able to comment on episodes that we post at TrentHornPodcast.com. Recently, I've been dialing back my interactions on social media, and that's going to be negligible, if not zero, very soon. I'll still post things on Twitter and Facebook, but if you go to my social media platform, you'll see there's far fewer, in some cases, no replies from me. And the reason for that is I've been trying to do an inventory of my time recently. I only have a finite amount of time. I mean, think about it in a day. You get a pie chart out, and you divide up how you spend your time. You got 24 hours in a day. Right away, I mean, ideally, 8 hours of that is going to go to sleep or things related to sleep, getting up for the day. Then you've got things like commuting to and from work and other things that kind of eat up your time. So the time that we do have is really precious and valuable. And I don't want to waste that. So I want to use my time as an apologist, creating resources to defend the faith, to build up people's faith, my time in my vocation, which is the most important thing that I do as a husband and as a father. I don't want to be wasting my time. And one of the places where I think our time can often be wasted is sucked into various debates on social media, Facebook or Twitter. Twitter can be especially unproductive for discussions because of the character limitations. Because you're only allowed 240 characters, your responses are condensed. And because of that, they often come off more condensed and less thoughtful. And I want to have thoughtful interactions with people. That's why I do this podcast and I invite people to come onto it. In fact, one of the authors of this survey, Anthony Magnabosco, who also does street epistemology, which I'll explain what that is here in a little bit, he's going to come on the podcast and we're going to have a dialogue about how Christians and atheists can have better conversations with one another. So if you want to interact with me about the podcast episodes or other topics, consider becoming a subscriber for as little as $5 a month. You get access to that bonus content among many others. And that, of course, is available at TrentHornPodcast.com. Now, on to the survey. So December 5th, two atheists, Rebecca Fox and Anthony Magnabosco, put out this survey. They collected about 850 responses. They got some other prominent atheists to retweet a link to their survey, and they asked about 36 questions, some demographic, some opinionated, such as, you know, what kind of an atheist are you? How old are you? What religion were you raised in, if any? And then other questions about why you let go. What was the process like for you becoming an atheist? How did your relationship with friends and family change as a result of this? So there's a lot of rich data here in this survey, and it's helpful for us as believers to be able to see what people are thinking, why do they lose belief in God, and especially for what I was interested in, is when do they lose belief in God? Because we often think that this is something that happens for a lot of people in college. You know, you go off to college and you're this well-formed young person with a bright and vibrant faith. And that does happen where you go to college and you meet the philosophy professor that wants to ram atheism down your throat. Now, I don't think most philosophy professors are like this. There are some that can be a little bit antagonistic, but I haven't met a professor that's like the professor in the movie God's Not Dead, where Kevin Sorbo, ironically, who used to play a mythological god, Hercules, is telling the class, I am the god in this class, and you will write in your papers, God does not exist or God is dead. I'm not familiar with a professor like that, but there are professors who they don't do that. What's even more insidious is not the philosophy professor who is like, you're a stupid Christian, I am going to destroy your faith. When you come at someone like that, the walls and shields are going to go up. You're not going to listen to the person. Rather, it's the student that goes to university and hears a winsome, knowledgeable professor who says, well, these are the arguments that Christians have put forward, but these are actually the objections to show those arguments don't work. And they'll often, you know, talk in their area of expertise, which is ironic because a lot of these philosophy professors, their area of expertise is not philosophy of religion. They're people who do metaphysics, epistemology, And they haven't touched philosophy of religion since their days in graduate school. And I know this because when I read philosophers, there was the chair of philosophy here at San Diego State University. Like a year ago, I talked about this on the podcast. He wrote an article in the New York Times talking about the God problem, like how God is a logical contradiction. And he's the chair of philosophy at SDSU. And I looked at some of his work, and he writes great stuff on like continental philosophy, the philosophy of like 19th, 20th century mainland Europe. But then when you get to philosophy of religion, it's hopeless. It sounds like something a freshman would write in philosophy 101. But the problem is these professors will talk to students and they use the PhD effect, you know, piled higher and deeper. They'll throw references and they'll talk about arguments and objections that a student has never heard of, and they're just amazed by this very knowledgeable person shaking their faith, not knowing there are other knowledgeable people who will disagree with this person. So that does happen. But I've noticed that one of the things that came out of this survey was that for many young people, they started to lose their faith in God before college. 44% of those in this survey said that they started to doubt the existence of God before they were 18, so in high school or even in junior high. And I've seen this. I've been invited to do talks at a local, not a middle school, it was the religious education for a parish nearby Catholic Answers for their junior high youth group. And when you go in there, you're like, these are like tiny children. Like, I remember being in when I was in junior high, I felt like I was a child among adults. Like there were those kids, you know, that hit puberty early. So there were these guys who were already taller than you and had mustaches, and girls who looked like they went to college. And you were the guy who talked like this. And so when you're there, you're like, oh gosh, this is horrible. Why am I here? Please, somebody get me out of this place. And so even now when I go back to give talks to junior high students, I'm like, oh gosh, I'm nervous. Junior high students are amazing at just picking out your insecurities. They have this laser-like ability to find that. And yet when I walked in there, you know, different than when I was a seventh grader walking around the halls of Ingleside Middle School in Phoenix, Arizona, they're like little kids. They look like they're like babies, they're like little kids walking around with their big oversized backpacks. And yet when they sat down with me, and I gave a talk on why we're Catholic, and I asked them for their questions. They asked questions like, well, how can God exist if there's evil? How can God be good when there's evil in the world? If God knows the future, then doesn't that mean my entire life's planned out for me and I don't have free will? Well, where's the proof that God exists? These were seventh and eighth graders who were asking these questions. Now, I gave them answers, and we had great dialogue back and forth, and that helped them because I could tell there's not a lot of people who had given them substantive answers besides saying, well, you just need to have faith. Even when you're getting late into fourth, fifth, and sixth grade for children, we got to stop treating religious education like Sunday school in the sense of, well, as long as you tell them the story, that's fine. This is not story time. We should not be telling stories to young people. We should be training them. Part of training is, of course, teaching them the biblical, historical, philosophical, and scientific foundations of our faith in accordance with their ability to accept those truths. So St. Thomas Aquinas once said, that which is received according to the mode of the receiver. And that's a fancy way of saying, don't fill up a Dixie cup, a paper cup, with a fire hydrant. You know, the knowledge you receive according to the particular mode of reception you're capable of. So you take water. If you pour water onto a plate, it won't turn into a column. You just can't because a plate is flat. You pour water into a glass, it becomes a column because a glass is disposed to receive the water in that way. In the same way, if you tell seventh and eighth graders the difference between existence and essence and the fine points of detail in St. Thomas Aquinas' third way of proving the existence of God from contingency, it's going to go over their heads. That goes over a lot of people's heads. But you can explain it to them in layman's terms that get them seeing that our faith is reasonable. That's something we should do. And that was just one of the results in the survey that I found interesting that I wanted to share with you. Before I share some of the other results of the survey, I want to add one caveat. When you read surveys, especially also when you read studies, be aware for biases in these studies. And this study, I think, this survey, I should say, is susceptible to a bias called volunteer bias. And it's not that bad because this is a survey of atheists. But one thing that could come off of it is that you might get a skewed view of what atheists think by reading this survey. And I'll post it at trenthornpodcast.com if you want to read the whole survey for yourself. Is thinking that most atheists, or in general, atheists in the population, share these views. I don't think that's the case. I think this survey is representative of the common views of atheists that like to hang out on Twitter and debate people. Because there's lots of different kinds of atheists. There's atheists who love going around debating other people about the existence of God and starting trouble with other people, basically. But there's a lot of other atheists who say, yeah, you know, I don't really talk about atheism. Eh, you know, I don't believe in God, but if that's what you want to believe, that's fine. I don't really care. And I think those atheists are severely underrepresented in this sample. Because Magna Bosco and Fox, when they put the survey out there, they just got some prominent atheists to retweet the link to their survey on their Twitter account. So you get a lot of people that are hanging out on Twitter who go and fill out this survey. And that's going to skew the results. So it's good at showing you the Twitter atheist, what he or she thinks, maybe not atheists in general. Here's why it skews the results. This is from the Pew Research Survey, so the Pew Forum, which has a lot of great surveys and studies to understand demographics. I highly recommend it. According to Pew, only 22% of American adults use Twitter. So one out of five, that's a lot. But the problem is a lot of people sign up for an account on Twitter, and then they do absolutely nothing with it. And that might be for their benefit, frankly. But Pew goes on to say that of that 22% of adults who use Twitter, 10% of that group posts 80% of the tweets. So if you break that down, 20% of Americans are on Twitter. 10% of them are responsible for 80% of Twitter's content. That means the vast majority of the content on Twitter is created by 2 to 3% of the US population. So because something is trending on Twitter, that doesn't mean the majority of people in the world care about it, because Twitter is not the real world. Twitter is not real life. That's why I'm dialing back on Twitter and social media, because it just isn't. You get sucked into this different kind of world where there are these skewed views and people act in ways they would not normally act in real life. Myself included, I've acted in ways on Twitter like, oh, I probably shouldn't have said this or done that. It's easy to be tempted to do that in these kinds of formats. And also the people that tend to congregate there and spend all their time on Twitter are just not representative of the population as a whole. So with that in mind, let me go through a little bit of the survey. And I'm going to play a clip, actually, that they made a video. I believe the narrator is Rebecca Fox, one of the co-authors of the survey. And I wanted to play two clips from it, dealing with interesting questions that come from it to see what atheists think. So a lot of the questions were demographic in their nature, like who are you, what do you, you know, age, gender, geography. Most of the people were from the United States or Canada. A lot of people from Poland, actually, which I'm surprised, because Poland was a very Catholic country. And also a lot of responses from Australia, which is a fairly secular country. It says most of the survey's respondents, here's interesting, most of the respondents are between the ages of 25 and 60. So while you would think that young people tend towards being non-religious, that didn't show up in this survey. Part of the reason most of the respondents are between 25 and 60 and you don't get a lot of people from like age 13 to 25 is I think young people don't hang out on Twitter. I think they're on Snapchat, Instagram, TikTok. I don't know. I'm going to be the person who says, are you using the Instagram? And people have asked me that. Trent, when are you going to get on Instagram? I'm going to say, well, when I don't care about myself being in sepia tone. When will I get on Instagram? When I can master the duck face. You know, I can't do that. I can't be someone who's on Instagram, you know, posing in front of a mason jar with sepia tone features. Not to diss my listeners who are on Instagram. I'm sure you have wonderful, lovely, photogenic lives you enjoy sharing with other people. That is just not my cup of tea, okay? So the majority of the people were ages 25 to 60. Said 88% of them were raised as Christians. Only 3% were raised without any religious beliefs at all. So most atheists you encounter have been, they're familiar with religion in some way or form. But we should always remember that someone, you know, I hear this all the time. I'll post something online and somebody will say, well, I went to Catholic school and, and they'll try to correct me on the faith because they went to like Catholic elementary and high school. And yet, of course, I've seen people graduate from Catholic schools with some of the most atrocious theology I've ever seen in my life. I have seen some of the most atrocious theology from Catholic high school theology teachers. There, that is the group. I've probably said it on the podcast before. The group that I'm not afraid, but it, I don't know, it's not afraid, it's not resent. I guess loathe. I don't dread it. I don't look forward to it. I mean, I do in one sense, because I want to share the faith and build up people, especially those who are charged with educating young people. But I know that when I go to speak for faculty at Catholic high schools, unless it's a really orthodox, faithful Catholic high school that, you know, tend to be the smaller ones, that I know is like, that is a solid school with solid faculty, solid teachers. I love going to those schools. But I have had the majority of times when I have spoken at Catholic high schools to the faculty, the faculty's been rude. I have articulated Catholic teaching accurately, and they have scoffed at it. I've seen teachers roll their eyes when I've answered questions and I've said, well, grave sins that are grave matter include things like abortion and the use of contraception. I've seen teachers, you know, roll their eyes at that kind of stuff. I'm like, that's what our church teaches. And so it's important to remember that when you encounter people who are atheists, many of them will have an exposure to Christianity or Catholicism. In fact, the survey said that the vast majority of people in the comments said that they were brought up Catholic and now they're atheists. So they'll have had an exposure to the faith, but I'm willing to bet you that exposure was warped or deficient in some way. And so you have an opportunity that really apologetics defending the faith, 80% of it is correcting people's misunderstandings about the faith. 80% of apologetics is pure explanation of what we actually teach. So that's something to focus on. And that's why if you want to be doing your homework, the best book you can read on apologetics, the second book would be Why We're Catholic by Trent Horn. The number one book is the Catechism. Just read the Catechism. 25 paragraphs a night should take you about 10 paragraphs a night. You read 10 paragraphs a night, should take you between 5 to 10 minutes. Do that Monday through Friday. Take the weekends off. Do it for a whole year. You'll have read the entire Catechism. That the Catechism is probably the most important book you can read on apologetics, because you can just share from there, this is actually what we believe. That's the important thing to share with people and to correct misunderstandings that people have. So when we go back into demographics more, 44% of the respondents doubted the existence of God before they became adults. So we've got to be able to share this truth and answer atheist arguments in high school, junior high, and probably late elementary school. So you've got a lot of people who doubt the existence of God, and they're minors, they're junior high, they're high school students. Some of them are going to be forthright. They'll tell their parents, or they're not, say, I don't want to go to church. But a lot of the others are, and this could be happening in your own communities, in your own families, will go to church, put on a happy face, and do it because you're supposed to, but you don't want to talk about it because you don't want to get in trouble. According to the survey, only 17% of those who doubted the existence of God spoke to family and friends, and nearly a quarter of them didn't talk to anyone. So you have these people who feel like, I can't talk to anyone. I doubt this. I don't believe this. And I don't have anyone to talk to. So they keep it to themselves, but they don't really keep it to themselves because they go and they seek out questions from unreliable sources. The most common one in this study, about 66% of people who said they stopped believing in God when they went to get answers, the 2/3 of the respondents said they went to books like The God Delusion or The End of Faith by Sam Harris. And that makes sense because the majority of these respondents are between ages of 25 and 60. So let's say you've got people here taking a survey in 2019, and most of them are late 20s, 30s, maybe early 40s. And it's 2019. If they started doubting their faith when they were in high school or they were in college in the early 2000s, then you didn't have a lot of atheist apologetics or atheist works on the internet. The most popular places people would go were books like The God Delusion, The End of Faith. There was that big craze in atheist literature, New York Times bestsellers from 2003 to about 2007 was the height of that. The number two spot that atheists went to get reassurance or to find answers was a particular website, one website I want you to guess, what do you think that website was? YouTube. They went to YouTube. That was about 45%. So I bet today that there are young people who are doubting their faith, who are having questions, they're going to go to YouTube. And we've made gains. I mean, back in the early days of YouTube, atheists were the ones who were getting on there first, putting up all these apologetic videos, and they still are. By the way, when I say apologetics, it's always funny. I'll meet atheists who will say, oh, the apologists for Christianity. And that's, of course, is not my voice for just atheists in general. It's the atheists who kind of have a bad attitude when talking to believers like myself. They'll say that apologist is a dirty word to them, like a used car salesman, somebody who overlooks the facts and twists the facts to fit their worldview. And I'm sure there are people who do that in all different kinds of fields. But the fact of the matter is, if you defend a belief system or a lack of belief system, if you defend the belief that there are no good arguments for God, or you try to debunk arguments for the existence of God or promote arguments against God, like the problem of evil, if you're an atheist who does that, congratulations, you're an apologist for atheism. Apologetics is not a dirty word. It's one who makes a defense. So we should all be able to meet one another equally at the table to see who has the best defense. So when these people would go to a place like YouTube or to an atheistic book and their faith is being shaken, half of the respondents said there wasn't a particular issue. It was a bunch of little things adding up. But 46%, so nearly half, said that they began to doubt the existence of God because of a classic philosophical problem about God. So I want to play a clip from the video that summarizes the results of this survey. One of the co-authors, Rebecca Fox, is the one who is narrating this.
I wanted to know what provoked people to begin questioning their faith beliefs. I was expecting people to say they noticed inconsistencies in their holy books or couldn't stomach the regressive attitude of their fellow believers. I asked, was there a particular big question or problem with your beliefs that troubled you first? The answers I expected were common, but in the comments beneath this question, I found my fellow philosophy nerds. The problem of evil came up. A lot. The problem of evil is a classic philosophical problem. It was first raised in ancient Greece hundreds of years before the Christian God was conceived. If God is all-knowing, all-loving, and all-powerful, in the words of Stephen Fry, bone cancer in children, what's that about? People reported personal tragedies and world events that prompted them to ask this question. 9/11 was mentioned several times. But for some, like Teresa, it was a small thing that made them start asking big questions.
The kid next door shot a hummingbird in our yard with a BB gun. I remember holding the bird as the life drained out of it, blood coating its jeweled feathers. I prayed so hard for this little bird to be saved. That's when the seed of doubt was planted.
Okay, so that gives you a bit of an insight into how when people start to doubt their faith, it's usually a big question about the existence of God. When you go in the survey, I noticed one of them was really funny, actually. I mean, it's not funny, obviously, for someone to doubt their faith. Ironic might be a word to use. And I've heard this from other people who stop believing in God. It's not the problem of evil, it's the problem of foreknowledge. They'll say, well, if God knows the future, then how could we have free will? And so they stop believing in God because of that. Now, I believe you can reconcile God's knowledge of the future with human beings having free will, but that's a subject for another episode. However, it doesn't follow. If that were your problem, you're saying, well, how could I have free will if God knows the future? If you couldn't resolve that dilemma, it wouldn't show that atheism were true. It would only show that you don't have free will. You would just embrace something like Calvinism, which says that God has predestined everything, and so you don't have free will. Or you could become a Christian who says, I believe in free will so much, I don't believe God knows the future. Those would be free will or open theism is the idea that God doesn't know the future. Now, I believe that God knows the future and humans have free will. It's a topic for another time. But just because you couldn't resolve that paradox, atheism doesn't come from that. You could just be a Calvinist or an open theist. But what's really ironic is, let's say you become an atheist then, like, oh, if God knows the future, I don't have free will. Most atheists think you don't have free will. They think you're just a biological machine who has to follow determined laws or even just random occurrences because of quantum mechanics. Most atheists, look at Daniel Dennett, look at Sam Harris. They believe that most atheists that I speak to They either say we don't have free will or we do have free will, but it's an incredibly qualified sense. So it's not really free will at all. So if free will was the big thing you're concerned about, don't become an atheist. Most atheists deny that we have free will. Instead, understand that God created us in his image. And so we have rational souls capable of freely choosing between good and evil. And because of that, God in his infinite wisdom will not allow his foreknowledge to determine what we will do in this life. So I thought that that complaint, which I've seen that concern about God's foreknowledge and free will leading to atheism, it's ironic because really, if you want to have free will, you should be a Christian and believe we have immortal souls. Now, on to the problem of evil. Once again, that's a subject we could do a whole episode on. It's important when you talk to people and see if they're atheists, you should help them distinguish between the philosophical problem of evil and the practical problem. The practical or personal problem is someone's just hurting and you're hurting really bad. Sometimes you just have to be there for that person. And if someone's just really hurting, sometimes you can just be very practical and say, let's put this philosophy aside. Look, if God is real, God can heal our wounds, and it takes time to do that. We may not even feel it in this life fully, but God can make everything right in the next life. St. Paul said that there's an eternal weight of glory that counterbalances, it outweighs any kind of suffering we endure in this life. And St. Paul knew about suffering. He would be lashed 40 times in a row. He was shipwrecked. He was stoned. People were out trying to kill him. He embraced all kinds of hardship, but seeing the ultimate goal of where God was taking him to his heavenly reward, he said there's that eternal weight of glory. So for someone who is just suffering immensely, I think that they can't always be rational. You're hurting too much. Sometimes you just have to be there for that person. Just give them that hug and say, no matter what, I'm here for you, even if you think God isn't. And then just say to them, look, let's say that there is no God. Does that make the problem better? Evil is still here. We're still suffering. If you lost a loved one, they're gone forever. They're worm food. Getting rid of God doesn't make anybody feel better. So for me, and I've never experienced a horrible tragedy in my life, but I would pray that if I did, I would say, you know what? I'm not giving up belief in the one thing that can reunite me with my loved ones and can provide an answer to the suffering that's happening now. Why would I give that up? Why? If there's no good evidence that God doesn't exist, why would I give that up? So I think that's important. We need to separate when the problem of evil arises, the personal problem of evil from the philosophical problem. And the philosophical problem, we can say, well, look, you're assuming God has no good reasons to allow evil. Maybe could God be justified in allowing evil? So people bring up things like 9/11. Well, if God could get rid of moral evil like 9/11, if he just took away our free will, do you think he should do that? Do you think he should make us all mindless robots? Or if he gives us the ability to freely love and care for others, is it possible we might misuse that gift? And we can help people think through the issues, help them see, look, how would God get rid of moral evil? You can't just snap your fingers and have God force us to freely choose to do good things, because that's a contradiction. The story about the hummingbird is really interesting. I could see where that person's coming from. I have an affinity towards animals. I told this story on the podcast, I think, a long time ago, or on Catholic Answers a while back. I was riding my bike here in Santee, a neighborhood here in San Diego, and it was around this lake, and I ran over a duck. And I didn't kill him, but he walked off, and he was all, like, hobbly, and then he got in the water and swam away. And I really was like, oh, God, please, I hope I didn't maim that poor duck. I didn't mean to, you know, is he a hit and run? And I felt bad. I felt bad about that, a little ducky. And I ran over and he slammed his head into the concrete, but he walked away, and I felt this guilt. And so you might say, like, how could God exist? What about all the suffering of animals? Moral evil, free will doesn't explain that. And I thought about it, like, well, God, why do these animals got to suffer like this? Now, I know the philosophical reason is that when God creates material things, they grow and decrease in their perfections. So there's always an increase or decrease in their perfections. The lion becomes more perfect as it eats the zebra, which becomes less perfect. When you have material things that interact with one another, there's an increase and decrease among them. And pain is something material things need in this world in order to ascertain danger, in order to function and live. If you couldn't feel pain, you actually wouldn't last very long. You would, you know, end up cooking your hand on a stove and not realize it because you couldn't feel pain. So I know the philosophical reason, but it doesn't always get to the heart. But what God kind of gave me in my mind to ease my heart was I thought, well, wait, let's say there were no God. Why in the world would I care about a stupid duck? It's just a duck. Now, people will say that without God, you can have morality and you can have moral rules that everybody agrees to, like you have rules about football that everybody agrees to without God. You don't need God to play a game of football, just like you don't need belief in God to create man-made artificial rules of morality. But if you want rules of morality that are objective, that transcend human opinion, that are unchanging, to say, look, that it's always wrong to directly kill an innocent person and we can't all get together and vote and change that rule, you need the moral rule to come from a source, that obligation to come from a source that transcends time, place, and culture. And so atheists, unfortunately, they don't always grasp this. They'll say, look, morality is something we evolved with so that we as human beings could learn to live with one another. And there is a truth to that, but evolution can't explain all of morality because survival of the fittest is not survival of the most moral. According to evolution, we should probably euthanize all children with genetic defects when they're born. And there's people who do try to do that. They're okay with abortion because you can't see the killing happening. But most of them wouldn't believe that we should take toddlers with Down syndrome and euthanize them. I hope most people wouldn't. Most people wouldn't. There's always the minority out there who are morally detached and their moral compasses have hit a magnetic zone and they're spinning around and around. But most people don't believe, truly believe, survival of the fittest is what morality should be based on. And yet, even in that scheme, evolution only explains morality between humans so we can get along with one another. Atheistic evolutionary morality can't explain why would I have a moral duty towards a non-human species? Why should I care about that duck? That duck doesn't care about me. That duck and his friends would turn on me in a second. And I've seen them do that, by the way. They get snappy when you run out of that bread at the park. Trent, do you really sit at the park like a septuagenarian and throw bits of bread into the lake for the ducks? Maybe I do that. We all have our hobbies that we enjoy, okay? But why? If this is just a material universe, there's no reason there's any moral obligations at all. But even if you try to create them out of evolutionary atheistic psychology, you can't get to say, why should I care about these non-human animals? They're not a part of my cohort. They're not a part of my species. Why should I care about them? Why should I have a moral duty to not cause unnecessary pain to non-human animals? But if God exists and he created the world and he made me and you and human beings to be stewards, to care for this world, to care for his creation, well, then all of a sudden we've got a good reason. We've got these moral obligations. So I think that ultimately, when we confront this issue, we should meet atheists where they're at, we should ask them questions, and we should slowly lead them towards rethinking the positions that they have. And know that it's a process, it's a journey, it's not a debate that you can end in four rounds on Twitter. It's something that we need to have those face-to-face conversations with people. And the last thing I'll end with is that if you have a child, or you know a child, or you know someone who says, you know, I'm an atheist. What I noticed in my book with Layla Miller, we wrote the book Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues. The advice we gave for what to do if your child comes to you and says, Mom or Dad, I'm gay, equally applies if your child comes to you or you know someone who comes to you, says, especially a young person who says, I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God. This is what we wrote. This is essentially Layla's advice. This comes from Layla's voice. She's an ace at how to deal with parenting issues, such since she has 8 kids of her own. She says, if your child says this to you, remember our golden rule. Don't freak out. As long as he or she isn't trying to be a crusader for a cause, the reason he confided in you is because he's struggling with fear and anxiety, and he knows you are a source of comfort and protection. In order to be that firm foundation, give him a huge hug and calmly ask questions like, how did you come to believe this? Or what do you think God wants you to do in this situation? That's more, if you say, Mom, Dad, I think that I'm gay. But you could apply here, Mom, Dad, I'm an atheist. Okay, well, if there is a God, what do you think he would want you to do and how you feel right now? And just to ask these kinds of questions. Layla goes on, this shows your child that you are committed to understanding him as a person. It also gives you time to assess the situation and respond graciously. Finally, don't expect to solve this issue in one conversation. take a breath and say a prayer, asking God or the Blessed Mother for the right words in this conversation and many future ones. And you should underscore to them, this is me piping in here, what the Catechism says in paragraph 157. It says, revealed truths can seem obscure to human reason and experience, but the certainty that the divine light gives is greater than that which the light of natural reason gives. 10,000 difficulties do not make one doubt. That it's okay to say to them, look, it's okay if you're struggling. It's okay if you have questions. You can always come to me. You can always come to me with your questions. As a parent, I know what it's like to hear something out of your kid, and the first thing you want to say is, where did you learn that? Who told you that? You're never going to school again. I'm homeschooled. Well, you're staying in your room then. And you want to, you want to, wait, where did you hear that? You don't freak out. That's the number one rule for Made This Way I wrote with Layla. Don't freak out. Then, if you need to freak out later, go ahead. Put the kids to bed, get a glass of wine, go ahead and freak out. Don't freak out with them right there. Put a calm face and just ask a question. Where did you hear that? Where did you hear that? Who told you that? Why did you think that? How did you start thinking this way? When did this start for you? How are you feeling? I'm really proud you came to me with something that's bothering you so much. I want to be here for you to answer questions you probably have. Let's talk about this. That's the kind of conversations that we need to have, and I hope you will have with people in your life who are struggling with faith, who have an absence of faith, or who've rejected God. Be there for them, ask them good questions, and lead them close to the truth. So thank you so much for listening today, and I hope you have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.